Good morning. The K-12 Education Finance Committee will come to order. The first bill that we have up on the calendar today is House File 1815, Representative Olson.
No, but I understand.
Representative Olson, did you want to move your bill?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. I'd like to move House File 1815.
All right. And you have an author's amendment?
Yes, I do, somewhere. Is it, it's the...
A1?
Yes, the A1.
H1815A1?
My author's amendment simply moves the audits into the Department of Education.
All right, so that's what it does.
All right, it's pretty straightforward.
All right. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The amendment is adopted. All right, now we have the bill in the order that you wanted.
Yes, Madam Chair. Sorry, I had notes written out and everything, and I don't have them now, but I drafted the bill, so I know it inside, outside, and backwards. This is another proposal that I got from the Education Commission of the State's scholarship I was on to Virginia. It's another proposal being authored in Virginia by Governor Warner. The efficiency review's idea is to go into school districts voluntarily. The superintendents or school board would apply to now the Department of Education for them to come in and do a review of expenses outside the classroom. And again, this is meant to be a positive review. It's voluntary. And the recommendations that the department would make would be voluntary back to the school district. So the school districts would make this information public as well for two reasons, so that the taxpayers in the district know, and also so that we can learn from those good practices being done throughout the state. One area that I think this would be very helpful would be in rural Minnesota, where some of the school districts can't necessarily afford thorough audits and suggestions from auditors and management specialists on how they're doing best practices in their school district. And so this would be an opportunity for them to apply to the Department of Education Financial Division to get assistance with that. And then that information, when made public, would be available to other neighboring rural school districts, just like it would be in suburban and the metro. And the idea would be that there would be at least three audits done per year at the discretion of more for the department if they're able to handle it, and that those would be one rural, one metro, and one suburban, so that we could continue to learn, because each of those school district areas are quite different as we hear day to day in this committee. This is being done in Texas, Arizona, now likely in Virginia, and saving schools millions of dollars. I know where is it that we saw in Texas? It has saved school districts over, these reviews have saved school districts over $381 million in Texas. And this is not money that would be reclaimed to the state by no means. It would help school districts get that money into the classroom more, because these savings that they are finding are outside the classroom. And it lists some of the areas that they are examining. And those include district leadership and organization management. In Texas, they look at educational service delivery, which we wouldn't necessarily do in the state of Minnesota under this proposal. They look at community involvement, human resources management, facilities construction and use of management, asset risk management, purchasing and warehousing, food service, transportation, and also safety and security. And frankly, Madam Chair, especially now that I have a family and every penny is counting as we pay off this trip we just got back and this new adventure, you know, I would welcome somebody with, you know, the background to come into my household budget and save me money. Because, for example, I know I'm spending too much for my Verizon wireless phone service, but I don't take the initiative, you know, different priorities of time to go in and find the best plan. So if somebody's willing to come in for free to me and help me save money on my phone bill, I can use that money maybe to get even more services for Grace, for example. So I see this as a positive way to help. I also have available that I'd like to call it Dick Government from the Department of Education to talk briefly, I think, about what his department division does right now. He does these things for SOD districts, so it wouldn't necessarily be an all-new policy for him. He just extended to districts that were not in SOD but just wanted to improve further. So if Dick Government could just come down and talk about his division and maybe what he does in SOD for SOD districts.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair, committee members. I do have a handout. I don't know. Did I get it?
No, I don't. Oh. No, I don't. I didn't get it.
Something like this? You didn't get it.
Did we get a financial management section handout?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, we did.
I apologize. I don't have one for everyone in the room. I didn't realize how many I needed to bring. I've been with the department for...
And if you'll just identify yourself for
Dick
the case.
Government, financial management, now transportation, facilities, health and safety. Those are the sections at this point in time. Been with the department for about 8 years, hired to do some financial management assistance for school districts and to build a section thereof. If you would notice on the handout that I've provided, the primary responsibilities are to provide business management assistance to school districts and charter schools. When I started the department, there were 426 school districts, approximately 421, I believe, and dwindling down to 343. Now we have projected a little over 100 charter schools, and so the numbers are starting to go the other way for the last 3 or 4 years, creating, you know, a situation where we have lots of entities again to oversee. We took on the process of training in the being of the attitude that preventative was better than waiting for something bad to happen. And to just go in when school districts already had to reckon with immediate stress and deal with SOD situations, statutory operating debt plans, and so on and so forth. That's one of our main jobs. Within the analysis that we are currently doing for school districts, it's predominantly looking at their overall system, but obviously most of the dollars in school districts are spent on salaries and fringe benefits, about 80% approximately, and therefore we do look at staffing ratios being all instructional and non-instructional, and this of course proposal is to look at the non-instructional areas. Hopefully that provides we do a lot of other things, but I don't need to read to you about that because we handle all of the accounting for schools and all of the reporting and so on and so forth. Do you have any questions?
Representative Bryant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was it Vermont?
Gabbermont.
Gabbermont. Okay, got that really backwards. Anyway, you said you've been working on this and it's non-instructional activities that you're looking at. I've been concerned because the districts I've been talking to have relayed to me that the help from the Department of Education in instructional areas has all but dried up due to funding cutbacks, And to me, that should be the paramount thing that we're, you know, promoting in the state is the instructional activities. Saving money is, if the districts could save money and that could actually happen, is certainly an opportunity that, given the financial straits that we've left our districts in, should not be a stone that we leave unturned. So I'm interested in this. I'm wondering, when you go out, since you already work on this with statutory operating district schools, how long does it take, and when you go out, what kind of a timeline are you on as far as getting to them, and then what kind of a timeline would you be on if lots of districts ask for this?
Mr. Gevermont?
Madam Chair, committee members, a hard question to answer since I just started to review what they're doing with this process in Texas, where we predominantly have done almost 100 of these. We are not.
What do we do for SOD districts?
Yeah.
How long?
It takes a. It's really a hard answer because sometimes we can get it done in a few days, and sometimes it takes weeks, depending on the severity of the SOD problem. Many districts, especially those that we've worked on over the last few years, have had a history of SOD status, and it's like a cultural renovation, if you will, and those districts obviously take a longer time than some of it fall in and get out very quickly. Many times, because of the size of the budgets and so on, the smaller districts are easier in and easier out because of just the finance, the economics of their whole budgetary situation. So it's a hard answer. We have five staff members. Two of us actually do the SOD work. We would not be geared at all to do something like this Texas piece at this point in time. It's not that we don't look at the various aspects of the school districts when we go in and try to help them with their efficiencies.
Madam Chair, just to follow up too, to clarify, the department isn't involved in this bill. They're just helpful in communicating what they currently do and why the bill was amended to the Department of Education instead. But if I understand correctly from my communications with Mr. Gevermont, their area concentrates on SOD districts and everything instructional and non-instructional, instructional, where my bill and the Virginia plan it's modeled after is just simply non-instructional. And business practices, everything from utility bills to telephones to paper and that type of thing to find savings. And that would be very limited. The bill is written to be at least three school districts so that we can kind of manage the cost at some point in time and they don't have to do all of a sudden, you know, hundreds of them. So we did try to limit it and we can grow it in the future if it is successful. Since Virginia talked about Texas, we researched Texas, but Texas seems to be even more thorough than what not thorough, but they really dive in with public hearings and that type of thing more than what I envisioned and I think Virginia envisioned in this process. So we're still learning from each of the other states that have done this, but I don't think at this point in time we'll go to the extent that Texas has with their public hearings and that type of thing. It's more looking at the books and seeing how to save, you know, money, very focused.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't realize you were only going to do it with three districts, so that's helpful that it's a smaller amount. But because my big concern with this is that we're displacing instructional help for school districts, which I think when we're right in the middle of a serious earth shift with new standards and tests that don't yet match and can't be done for 2 years because of budget and time limitations, that now we're adding in another non-instructional activity. That's what I'm trying to get a handle on the workload with the current workload that the department has, and if we were going to be doing this, what would that factor, you know, would that be a monkey wrench in needing more staff and taking even more time away from instructional activities? So I guess I should ask again, Mr. Gevermont,
can I address your comments just for a second, but before your second question, Madam Chair?
Representative
I probably didn't add to it. The amendment does have an open appropriation, and what we were, what I was envisioning is what it would be possibly for the three, at least three, so that if they did have the time to do so, they could extend that, but that it would be one FTE added to the department for which would have expertise, which would be Mr. Gethermont's, if that helps clarify. And the purpose is to, you know, our growing costs aren't just salaries and wages that we always hear about, but utilities. We've seen fuel bills. We've seen, you know, other things, with it, whether it's counselors or what have you, where costs are rising, and technology. And so those are real expenses that are growing and taking money out of the classroom. So if we can help school districts save money on non-instructional practices like that, then that does send more money in the school district into the classroom. Thank you.
And did you want to ask Mr. Gethermont? And
I wasn't even finished. He just interrupted me, and so I would like to finish.
Okay. Would you? You wanted to ask him that question?
I was in the process.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. To get back to my question, but Representative Olson, that was helpful. I hadn't noticed in your amendment that you added an appropriation. So now I guess I would like to know, what is the appropriation? We just have a blank here, and that makes me even more concerned that it can't be assimilated under current staff, which is what I was getting at here with Mr. Gethermont. Could it be assimilated under the current workload and the current staff? And the answer is no, it couldn't be. We're going to spend money on this for three school districts when we've cut early childhood and family education for all school districts, et cetera. And so I guess I strongly object them to spending more money on non-instructional activities at a time when we've cut instructional activities. And so I strongly oppose this bill unless it could be done with current workload. And that's what I'm trying to ask Mr. Gethermont, if I could proceed with that. How I'm trying to find out how fast you get to the districts that you're currently assigned, the statutory operating districts. Do you get to them all in a timely manner, or is there a backlog? And what do you consider a timely manner?
Mr. Gethermont.
Madam Chair, committee members, by statute, the districts who fall into SOD must have a statutory operating plan to us by the 31st of January. Thereafter, the fiscal year ends June 30 prior. Therefore, we are with those districts sometimes well before they finish their books prior year. I believe we are effective in getting to those districts that in statutory operating debt. We have some difficulty in getting to all districts that have financial stress that ask for our help, given in our current staffing.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions? Representative Business.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Olson, I understand the need for the open appropriation when this is given to the charge of the department. I have to ask you, have you looked into the private sector? Efficiency reviews are pretty commonplace amongst corporate America. I got to believe that there are private entities which could do this, and with the ultimate beneficiary being the school system itself, they would probably be intrinsically motivated to seek that. Have you looked into the private sector at all for having these analysis done?
Representative Olson?
For this bill, not necessarily, but I don't think we've seen a lot of people in the private sector volunteering to do this. So, you know, I welcome any accounting firm to volunteer for Anoka, Hennepin, or Osseo to help them improve their paperwork and their business practices, but I don't think we see the private sector stepping forward to do that voluntarily.
Madam Chair?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Olson, your bill doesn't ask for volunteerism either. Your bill, in fact, sets an open appropriation to fund this in the private sector. Why would you ask them to volunteer, and yet the public sector, you're willing to use taxpayer dollars? I guess maybe you misinterpreted my question. I wasn't asking whether you've asked them to volunteer to do this, but whether or not you've sought the private sector to look at this rather than use the department.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Representative Brooks-Skins, thank you for the follow-up. In Texas, as we were researching it further, when Virginia kept researching, referencing Texas, Texas does, because of its vast size, apparently, is my interpretation, contract with outside firms to do such, so that the department, where it's located, you know, doesn't necessarily have to travel all over the state of Texas to do these. So they are deciding to use outside contractors for assistance in the other, in the various specialty areas. But that's at the department's discretion.
Right. Thank you. There's no further questions. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Olson. I run a nonprofit when I'm not here. And a few years ago, we decided to really invest in technology as a way to reach our goals and be more operationally efficient. What we discovered as we did that, however, is that the more we got into exploring the technology, the more we discovered that we needed to spend more on technology, and it became eventually a slippery slope of maintaining databases and having gurus and, you know, virus checkers and all that kind of stuff on hand. We still think, however, that in the long haul, that that increase, you know, investment in, reflected in my budget, is going to lead to greater operational efficiencies, and we're already seeing that in our organization. And so my question has to do with the way this language is structured in the bill, where we're going to help, you know, the schools to identify opportunities for both operational efficiencies and reduce costs. And it seems to me that there might be an inherent tension here because, as I just stated in my organization, reducing costs, at least over the intermediate, wasn't synonymous with creating operational efficiencies. In other words, I needed to spend more money, at least for, you know, the first several years, in order to get the kind of operational efficiencies that's going to help my organization and the people that we serve. And so my question is, can you see a situation where, in fact, those might be colliding sort of expectations of these audits? And two, do you see a situation where an auditor might come back and say, you know, they just simply do have to spend more money if they're going to make that technology work in that school and reach the outcomes that they need to reach? And if so, does this bill kind of allow those auditors to be able to do that?
Madam Chair. Representative Mariani, you're exactly right. Sometimes we have to spend money to save money. We see that in corporations, in our own house budgets or whatever. And all the recommendations, first of all, our recommendations are all voluntary. But I did read examples, again, from Texas where, you know, they said that there was a particular school program that was very expensive to run. But the benefits of that program justified the expense. And I think that would be the same kind of thing with technology. The investment in technology in the end will probably lead to greater efficiencies and, you know, best practices. And in the research that I've done on this, they do look at all facets of that. So they would justify this in this case, if that is indeed the case, that the investment in technology was an outside classroom cost in some cases, but it was justified by the benefits of perhaps, you know, one less staff person or increased efficiencies or what have you. So, yeah, they would look at all of those cases.
And Madam Chair, just then a quick follow-up here, not a question, more a statement. You know, I'm all for reducing costs wherever I can. I'm sure that, you know, that's not a partisan issue here at all. But just a cautionary note is typified by, you know, this question that a single-minded focus on reducing costs, and I'm not suggesting that that's what this bill does, but, you know, needing to raise the question, doesn't always get us at the kind of outcomes and the goals that we want to get at. And, you know, to me it's a little disturbing that there are people out in the general public whose single-minded orientation is just simply to reduce costs. And I hope that as we push forward with this bill or any other bill, that we're able to balance, you know, the desire to control unnecessary costs with the very real world need sometimes to actually spend more money to get the kind of outcomes that we want from our educational system.
Madam Chair.
Representative Olson.
And, you know, Representative Mariani raised good points, and that's why it's not just to save money, but their efficiency reviews, because in many cases, increased technology leads to increased efficiencies. So it's not just about saving dollars. It's about, you know, in a lot of cases in these audits, they've found exemplary practices in the school districts that they went into, and they've made that public, saying, hey, we found really good things. And then other school districts can learn from that. So it's not just finger pointing or down to the dollar. It's about increasing efficiencies and promoting best practices across the state.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Segrin. Representative Olson, I'll ask you this question because Mr. Guillermont went back to his seat. Did he ever say in the presentation how many school districts have requested the assistance of this division of program finance?
I guess I can call it Mr. Guillermont to answer that question. I just told him we could probably sit down.
Madam Chair, committee members, we receive anywhere between 50 and 100 calls a day. Many of them relate to questions whereby we're providing accounting advice or budgeting advice and so on and so forth. It's a hard question for me to detail.
But, Madam Chair,
Representative Erickson,
I think what you're pointing out is that the service that you provide, especially now under our new commissioner, is essential to our school district's efficiency. And if in any way Representative Olson's bill can make the workings at a school district level better, more efficient, more effective, we're all for that, right?
Mr. Guillermont.
Madam Chair, committee members, it's hard to be against efficiencies.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Guillermont. We need to move on to the next bill. Thank you, Representative Olson. The next bill is House Bill 2195, Representative Lindgren. Welcome, Representative Lindgren.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for being able to talk to you this morning. House File 2195 is intended to provide functional support to school districts with high costs for internet and telecommunication access. And I believe that funding for the telecommunication access for schools is a very critical part of the Minnesota schools today. I have just learned this morning that there are a lot of young people out there whose only access to the internet is in the school system itself. I was kind of had the impression that we all have internet at home, and a lot of people are using that for schools use. And despite the growing need for increased telecommunication access, many school districts have been led to discontinue the use, mainly because of high costs and a disparity in access charges. For instance, the difference between access for a T1 line between Floodwood and Osseo is about three times the difference. It costs three times as much in Floodwood as it does in Osseo. And the department would like to reimburse the districts in the following manner: that the public schools, the aid would be equal to 90% of the amount of the unreimbursed cost exceeding $15 per student, and for non-public schools, the aid would be equal to 90% of the amount of the unreimbursed cost exceeding $10 per student. And as I did say in my opening remarks, that I believe that funding for the telecommunications access for schools is a very critical part of Minnesota's ability to provide equitable and high-quality education to their students. And, Madam Chair, I do have people to testify and other people here. So I stand for questions.
Representative Lindgren, we probably want to move your bill, House File 2195, to be before this committee. Representative Erickson.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd be delighted to move
All
House
right.
File 2195.
All right, to be before our committee for consideration in the K-12 education finance bill.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your waiver.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Renee Hasbarg, and I'm with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. You're going to hear from actual experts on this bill, students and teachers and tech coordinators and others. So let me just set the big picture on the bill, if you don't mind. This is, in the governor's supplemental education budget, his biggest expenditure. And I'd like to try to capture for you, in a very small bill, it's a big expenditure, why it is so important. And as you are well aware, the Constitution calls for a uniform system of education. And as we step into an information age, as Representative Lindgren has just pointed out, access to Internet in our school classrooms is going to be absolutely essential if every child is going to have equal opportunity. And as he pointed out, the difference between two school districts is 3-1. But as you actually look down district by district, you can find that in Plummer, it costs $300 a pupil a year for a child to have Internet access in that school. And in St. Paul, it costs 75 cents. So that's a difference of 300-1 in that case. What the governor does in this bill is he reduces that gap down to about 15-1. Having said that, the gap would be reduced to 15-1 if the bill were completely funded. That would take another $1 million above the $4.5 million the governor has in this bill. So his whole purpose here is to lower the gap, and we thank him for taking the lead on this issue. Now, if Minnesota is going to maintain leadership at all as an education state in an information age, then we have to have not only equal access to the Internet in every classroom, but we'll need to have computers in the hands of our students. We will need to have much more capacity in our lines out there than we have currently. We'll have to have a seamless system between higher ed and K-12 and libraries. And we will have to have a way to connect our school districts out there with the departments so that we can do online testing and we can do online reporting of data. All of these things are just essential for our schools of the future. So if we want to maintain a leadership position, it's important that we invest here now. Having said that, I'm going to say with absolute frankness, we are losing ground. In the governor's, in the last 4 years of Governor Carlson's term, Governor Carlson invested $120 million in telecommunications for schools. $120 million. In the 4 years of Governor Ventura, he invested $60 million. And in the first 2 years of Governor Pawlenty's term, he has invested nothing. This bill is the first investment, and it is $4.5 million. That's a long way from the vision that we had just not even 6 years ago to 10 years ago, that this was so important that we were going to invest $120 million. So I urge you to keep Minnesota a national leader and see the importance right now of reinvestment in telecommunications access before we further lose what we have out there. Because already in the last year or two, we have had 100 video connections that used to connect our schools shut down. And we don't think losing ground and going backwards is any kind of model for the state of Minnesota. Having said that, you need to hear the promise of telecommunications access to students and to teachers in the state. And so I will turn it over to them to tell the story.
And members, just for your clarification, too, on the $120 million that Ms. Hasbargen mentioned, that was to build a backbone and an infrastructure out to our school districts. It wasn't telecommunications access. It wasn't paying for that. That was a one-time appropriation that was to build the backbone, which was completed. There was another $60 million to continue some of the additional backbone, but it wasn't necessarily for telecommunications. Now what we're looking at is after the backbone has been built, making sure that we do have access. And under the Ventura administration, the monies for the telecommunications sunsetted, and there was never an agreement. The House has carried bills for funding that. When we got to conference committee, we didn't succeed in convincing the Senate to fund some of those appropriations. So we've been kind of in this limbo land here in the last couple of 4 years of trying to get this move forward and back on the table again. So I appreciate the governor's trying to move this forward in a time that we've had some tough economic decisions to make. Mr. Warren, do you want to start, or would you like your student to start?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lee Warren. I'm the executive director of the Service Cooperative in Marshall. I have brought with me a student from Westbrook Walnut Grove, Jenny Lund, and I'm letting her do most of the talking. I think she's a lot smarter than I am anyway. I would just like to follow up that I did a study in our region. I had 57 school districts that cover the bottom quarter of the state. And the range in our region per pupil costs after the E-rates are paid range from $5.32 to $142.39 a pupil. Wide disparity. And it isn't just indicative of rural areas. Some of the urban areas have disparities in costs of over $15 to it. Depends upon the ability to connect. In our areas, I graduated from Orono. I had lots of opportunities. And in my region, there are some kids that go to school that don't have lots of course choices. And so being able to take them online is a big deal. I asked Jenny Lund from Westbrook Walnut Grove to come with me. They've got about 580 kids in the high school, or K-12, excuse me. And she's taking a civics course. And I asked her to just share with you her experiences of taking this course.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Jenny Lund from Walnut Grove. I go to Westbrook Walnut Grove High School. I'm taking the civics class online because there is no other way to fit it into my schedule. And I need the class to graduate, and being a senior is very important that I got it in. The civics class challenges me. I'm gaining a lot of experience in writing essays, which I was never good at. I'm learning about the U.S. government, state government, local government, and how they all tie together. I would recommend this for other students. Online courses are important for many reasons. First of all, they're easy to fit into your schedule because you can do them at any time. Secondly, you can work at your own pace. There's no one telling you when assignments need to be handed in, which also requires a lot of responsibility. Online courses are nice for people living in rural Minnesota because there aren't a lot of class opportunities. There's a variety for you to choose from. You can take something as simple as civics or as complex as anthropology. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? No? Okay. All right. Mr. Representative Lindgren, do you want to bring up your other testifiers?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just doing some checking. I was trying to explore your comment that the House had been willing to do telecommunications funding, but not the Senate, and that didn't ring with my memory. So now I understand you're talking about, you know, a couple of sessions ago. But just for clarification for people in the audience, and I did just check with the fiscal staff, there was zero in the House bill last year, just as there was zero in the governor's proposal, as Ms. Hasbargen just testified to, for telecommunications. So it was not the glorious House proposal that there was money for telecommunications, but in fact there was money in the Senate Democratic bill, and Mr. Crow recalls it was about $10 to $15 million as compared to this $5 million proposal that Representative Lindgren is bringing forward. The problem, as I understand it, with the Senate proposal for $10 or $15 million, which would have been recouping half or three-fourths of what Governor Plenty did not fund when it expired with Governor Ventura's proposal, was funded by a source other than, it was funded by a tax, and the House did not agree to that because of all the no new taxes philosophy, and I myself didn't like the Senate's funding source either. But nonetheless, I just wanted to, in case anyone thought that the House proposed money for telecommunications last year for rural schools, I think our rural members know that isn't the case, even though they fought for it, and but the Senate did. And so I think we should just get that clarification.
Yeah, Representative Growling is right. I was referring to 4 years ago when the House's position was to fund telecommunications. The Senate did not. So we kind of gone back and forth trying to figure out how to do this and pay for it after the telecommunications program sunsetted under the Ventura administration. As Representative Growling mentions, the Senate had a proposal to tax your telephone bills to pay for it. Both she and I agree that that was not the way to do that, and we, because we had a $4.5 billion crisis in our state, that was something that we were not able to do, but we are trying to build that back up now and try to fund it, and appreciating the attempt to doing that in a time when we have a very tough fiscal situation.
Madam Chair, committee members, I would just like to take this time. This is really kind of neat because I thought the lights would get lighter and everything around here because you have the distinct pleasure to have two Bagley High School graduates in your presence. Mr. Holland and I graduated from Bagley High School, and it's kind of cool because his dad was my parents' best man, and they just celebrated his parents just celebrated their 61st wedding anniversary yesterday. Just fantastic. So this man knows it all. Thank you.
Welcome. And please say your name for the tape.
My name is Stephen Holland. Presently live in Pine City, Minnesota, and manage a telecommunications co-op in central Minnesota. And as much as I think I know, I'm going to have Brittany Jewell and Steve Parkinson do most of the talking. That's like Lee Warren said. These are the practitioners. They know what's going on. And Brittany and Steve will enlighten you a little bit, and I'll follow up.
I'll go first here. Again, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members, and just want to thank you for this opportunity to share firsthand my experiences of teaching telecommunication and also the merits of that and internet access here and our school system. My name is Steve Harquison. I teach at Pine City High School, and I've taught there for 24 years, and 18 of those I've had the privilege of teaching on the interactive system. So your committee room kind of reminds me of my cable room here. It's just a wonderful opportunity, folks, as you are aware. Again, I teach advanced placement European history. For those not too familiar with that, that is a nationally recognized program for highly motivated college-bound students for them to have an opportunity to get college credit while they're still in high school. So keep on sitting for that test. I teach advanced placement European history, and again, that would only be made possible if it wasn't for the cable system. Pine City also offers advanced placement calculus and AP chemistry, astronomy, upper level, German upper level, French, Spanish, and we even have Chinese from year to year, depending on our Chinese exchange teacher that we have coming through. Again, wonderful opportunities that we would not have otherwise, if it wasn't for the telecommunications system. I graduated from Wayzata, and I teach in Pine City. It's just such a wonderful opportunity that these young people have, for the challenges and the curriculum enrichment that otherwise wouldn't be made available just due to the fact of our enrollment situation. So I'm going to keep this really, short and sweet. I just hope and Brittany here, our students and our parents as well, hope that you guys will continue to support ITV and, of course, our greatest resource here in Minnesota, which is our young people, as we try to keep them prepared and prepare them for the challenges of our ever-changing world. So thank you very much.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Brittany Jewell, and I'm a student at Pine City High School. But I would just like to say that, in my experience, I think that school is more about... It's not just the facts that you learn in the textbooks. It's also the experiences that you deal with and how that affects your life. In smaller schools, we tend to get stuck with just the basics. There isn't much for choices. And even though we're a smaller body of students, it doesn't mean that we don't necessarily have a large amount of interest. And with the ITV classes, we have students who have had the math classes, have the English, and we're looking for a little bit more. People who can take sign language and AP European history, and it's just a whole new experience. For example, in our history class, we have Mr. Godfrey, who is this war guru. I mean, every time we talk about Napoleon or anything, he's getting on there with these maps. It's just a whole different feel for something. When we also have the internet in our school, And every single project I've ever done, I have used the internet extensively. Because if you go to the library, you can have the encyclopedia, which gives you the facts and the basics, and you have other books, but it's not this huge amount of variety, and you usually don't have more than a few perspectives. But when you're on the internet, it's insane. You've got eyewitnesses, you've got people who are biased, you've got people who are unbiased. You have all sorts of different viewpoints represented right in front of you at your fingertips. Also, there aren't a lot of kids who can necessarily afford to have internet home. I didn't have it for a long time. When I did, it was like, woohoo, shopping time. No, anyways. So you go to school, and every single project that you do, that is your information outlet. And you also, in this world, we're becoming more and more technology-based. And if our students don't know how to work a computer, what are they going to do when they go to college and all these other students can, they can get on the computer, they can find the information, they can process data, and they're coming into this world, and then there's people who haven't had that experience that are way behind. And so I think that technology is very important, and I think that ITV classes have opened up a whole new perspective and experience for our students. So, thank you.
Thank you. Very good testimony. Were there further questions of any of the people at the table, or did you still wish to make a statement? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I haven't made a statement yet.
Go ahead.
Fine, Madam Chair. Just a couple of points. One is that I would like to point out Representative Sandra Erickson, our world-famous ITV instructor from Princeton. I don't know if many of you know this, but she was an ITV instructor on our system for a number of years and did an excellent job. So she understands what these kids and teachers are talking about. We think it's essential to our schools to have a network, and not just an internet connection, but a network that connects us to the rest of the world. And by that I mean being able to do internet to experiential field trips, for instance. Being able to have a teacher from Braham, Minnesota teach right now to Baudette, which is quite a ways away from here. Being able to teach to Hancock, Minnesota. Being able to have a past graduate from Pine City School who's a weed scientist at the University of Illinois, being able to have that person dial into a biology class and relate his experiences. And we've all read about Roundup Ready soybeans and the factors they're going through now when they find out that weeds are becoming immune to Roundup, and that's the projects they're working on. And to be able to have, we're not going to be able in Pine City School to extract the DNA out of a milkweed plant probably in the near future. But we've done that because the student at the University of Illinois can do that. And through our interactive television system, we're able to bring those experiences right into our classroom. We think that's very important for any student in this state. We really like this bill. We think it's a good first step. And the Commissioner of Education, at a meeting we were at in October, recognizes the fact that it is a Band-Aid. It is a place to stop the bleeding. If we wanted to make it much better, we wouldn't have $15 per pupil unit on there. Incidentally, Minnesota is the only state right now that does not have some kind of state-funded telecommunication system to the K-12 arena. We think it's very important that we have a seamless network between the K-12, the public library, the MinSCU system, and the U of M system. And that's very hard to get if you have every district buying internet service from a private broker. This network needs to be a network. And we're hoping that we can get back on track with some funding. The backbone that was talked about before, just to clarify a point, it's never been a purchased backbone. The concept was leased from telecommunications providers. So once the lease agreements aren't paid for, that system goes away. And unfortunately, as Ms. Hardbargen noted, we have lost over 100 video connections in the last 3 or 4 years. We feel that's very unfortunate. I think think we're up at time.
Are there questions for any of the witnesses? Representative Erickson.
I just wanted to tell the Madam Chair, the Pine City folks, that Dan Voce is my former student.
Perhaps one of you, would you know, and probably you, it's Mr. Hallen, correct?
Right.
Since you referred to it, how many districts are there with no access to telecommunications? How many would you say there are?
I believe everybody has some level of access. Whether or not that access is a high-speed telecommunication line or if they've had to buy that down to a DSL service or something, I couldn't tell you those figures. We can get you those figures. But there's, I believe, probably a couple in each region of the state that have had to go away from their high-speed connection. The part we do know is they dropped the video connection because their budgets wouldn't allow them to maintain those connections.
So maybe 25 districts around the state?
And just from a teacher's perspective, one of my, districts
Mr.
that
Parkerson.
I talked to was, Madam Chair, it was Chisago Lakes, and their equipment, the technology wasn't up to ours, so all he could do, that student, was just see me. He couldn't see the other students from the other sites.
Okay.
And it was extremely difficult for this young man to take this class and have to repeat everything that the other school said, so that he could kind of hear what was going on. So if we have, the funding to have the technology that everyone's on the same page, then the quality of education doesn't get compromised.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. There is a question. Representative Latz.
Madam Chair, thank you. What's that?
Yes. I'm sorry. It's Eakin. I'm sorry. I'm so
no
bad
problem.
At my other committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you kind of clarified it a little bit here. When Representative Seguin spoke, she talked about the backbone and as though the system was complete and that all that was needed was a little bit of money just to keep it going now and that the initial expenditures were larger as a result of that. And I was I wanted to ask whether the backbone is complete, and you partially answered that by saying that actually there's not a purchasing of the backbone, it's a lease. And so once the money was cut back, we see, as you said, lost over 100 video connections over the last 4 years. So it's been having a detrimental effect on the development of telecommunications in our rural communities. And so I guess I'll still ask the question as far as the network. Is there much more that needs to be done with the network in developing it?
Is there anybody else on the list?
The network itself has stayed kind of intact, and I say kind of because at one time the metro area was connected in a network. The metro area schools are not as connected in a network environment as, say, the schools I deal with. So all the schools basically hub back to a network, so we share resources amongst each other, which is unfortunate for us because we have a population of students that occasionally a family wants Russian, for instance. Russian was a curriculum offering that Stillwater had. When Stillwater dropped out of that network, we couldn't get Russian anymore because the teacher was not available. We couldn't connect. So that is an unfortunate thing. Southeast Minnesota, as a consortium of schools, has lost that network feel. They still have individual schools that are buying some connectivity, but they are not in the network environment. South Central, Northwest, Northeast, and Central Minnesota still have what we would consider network environments.
Right, hearing no other questions, gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony, and this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. We are not going to have the presentation of Teaching at Risk. The person that was coming from Washington, D.C., and she got hung up, I think, with bad weather or something. I will draw your attention to this book. It's actually very readable, and I've seen Representative Dabney looking it over. It is actually just a compilation of a number of things that are going on in many different states. The people, as I understand it, and I have not had a lot of opportunity to meet with these people. I think Representative Sikora may have had a meeting. Is the person that's kind of organized this group is the former chair of IBM, and he and then you can see in the front there's all sorts of people there that are interested in these initiatives, and it's just looking at all sorts of teaching initiatives, professional development ideas, many different topics in the book, and I found myself reading it very, it's a very easily read book, and you may want to just look it over, and maybe at some other point in time we'll be able to have them back, but I think it's a relatively new organization, so for your information. The next bill that we have on agenda is House Bill 2126, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2126, I would move for consideration in the omnibus bill.
All right, so moved.
Members, I have with me Christine Carr, who is the business manager of 916 Northeast Metro Intermediate School Districts, one of our three intermediate school districts that are put together for special education, technical education, and other educational services. And back when I was on the school board in the late 80s, we worked and I helped with passing a bond that was for buildings that were cooperatively added onto between the school districts and the Northeast Metro Intermediate School District. They have done all that work, and now they are ending up with a fund balance of $240,000. They would like to apply that to a building that is also, well, actually used to be in my district, but it's close to my house, but now is in Representative Jacobson's district. And that building has danger of water and mold problems with windows needing replacing, which will cost close to $1 million. They would like to use this one-time money to start that project, and I will turn it over to Ms. Carr to add to that, and then we both will stand for questions.
All right, go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As Representative Greiling stated, we do have a fund balance in our debt service levy. That was the debt. Those bonds were paid off at the end of 2003, and our audited balance is $240,817. We're requesting this one-time transfer into a restricted fund balance in the general fund to begin window replacement at the Capitol View Center. The building is over 45 years old and still has all the original windows. And currently, as an intermediate district, we have no source of capital revenue. We don't get any aid or any money to do deferred maintenance. The only source we have is to actually increase our tuition or membership fees to our member districts, which is then taken out of their general fund. So we would request that we could use this $240,000 to begin this project. We've already spent in excess of $170,000 to repair the exterior facade on the building to help with the water intrusion, but structural engineers are telling us the next step is we do need to replace the windows. Any questions?
All right, are there any questions? Representative Vistance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garland, you said that the building was in danger of mold problems. Is there any identifiable mold problem currently?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the memo that I have from 916, I'll read you what it says and then Ms. Carr can fill in. It says, if these problems, because they've had water intrusion and increasing issues with water intrusion for the past 2 years, unchecked, this could lead to severe health and mold problems in the building. And so that's, I was going by the information that they provided me. And Ms. Carr, do you have anything to add to that?
Madam Chair?
No.
Ms. Carr? What we do have is it's an older building, and it's 130-some thousand square feet and many banks of windows. It has an interior courtyard that is totally window, all windows. And on two sides of that, there is water leaking down inside the windows onto the flooring. So what we've done is repair the exterior facade. We've done all the tuck pointing, the resealing, those types of things. But there still is water leakage because in the old windows, there's like a felt lining between the window barriers. That is worn away. And we've been working with BKBM Structural Engineering, and they have advised us that to really get rid of the water coming into the building, we need to replace those windows. Currently, we've been...
Would that appropriation be enough to replace all those windows?
No. We'll have to spend in excess of $1 million in the next couple of years to totally replace the windows. But what this would do would let us replace two banks of windows that are the most severe.
Where would you be getting the money then for the rest of the replacement windows?
We will have to assess it either through a membership fee or through a tuition fee to our member districts. So it will end up coming, that portion will end up coming out of their general funds.
All right. Representative Growling, did you say that Representative Jacobson actually represents this area?
Madam Chair, yes. The line is Rice Street. This is right on the line. He has the east. I have the west.
Representative Growling?
Or actually, Madam Chair, now that I'm thinking about it, this is this Roseville or Maplewood?
It's in Little Canada.
Okay, it's Representative Jake. Okay, I'm right. Okay. There's a lot, three cities that come together right there. So I thought for a moment I was wrong, but I wasn't.
Representative Growling, did you ask Representative Jacobson to be on your bill?
Madam Chair, the lobbyist came around with this committee, and I just signed it and gave it back. And it would have been a good idea, though, to
yeah,
have
probably would have been
have
a good
him
idea.
Do it.
You brought that up a couple of times.
Yes, yes, yes.
So.
Yes,
you might want to.
Touché, Madam Chair.
You might want to ask him today if he would like to be a co-author of your
Madam
bill.
Chair, I will do that. It would be a very good idea.
All right. Okay. All right. Are there any other questions, Representative Biskins?
Thank
and
you, then Madam Chair. A question probably for Mr. Crow, but Mr. Crow, where does the excess money in the debt redemption fund, where is it required to go currently by law?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the debt redemption fund money under current statute would reduce the property tax levy in the next year if the district has a debt excess.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative
Mr. Strom, thank you. So my understanding then is that it would go back to the taxpayers who put it in via a reduction in the levy. Is that correct?
Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, yes.
Thank you.
That was exactly my question.
All right.
We're beginning to think alike, and it's very frightening.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yes, this would be a reduction in the taxpayers' tax bill if we did not do this. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, one closing comment. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, the taxpayers are going to pay for it either way, because if they don't use this money, which is sitting there, then they're going to be, the school districts are going to be assessed for it. So either way, I don't think we can have children in buildings where there's mold and water, and we all know if we don't take care of it, it gets worse. So one way or the other, the taxpayers are going to pay.
Right. Now, this building, though, is not a building. Is it being used for students? It is for the charter school, isn't it?
Ms. Farr. There's currently four special education programs located in the building,
okay.
And there is also a charter school located in the building, so it is used for educational purposes.
Okay, great. Thank you for that information. All right, the last bill. Thank you, Representative Growling. The last bill, and I'll just stay here. It's a very, very brief bill. You will have the page is going to hand out the just the House research overview for you. In just a minute, I'll explain the bill. The Advanced Placement International Baccalaureate Program was funded at $778,000 for this biennium. There are a couple, and Ms. Peters, Milius, do you want to come up from the department? Ms. Peters Milius had brought this to my attention, and I thought, oh, you know, this was not the intent. She was inquiring about the intent of the legislation that we had passed last year. If you look on Clause B of the bill, this is current law, it says that 75% of the appropriation would go to the Advanced Placement Program and 25% to IB. Then if you look in Clause C, and then it says, and further, it says, then each one of these respective organizations can distribute the monies that they receive between their training needs and paying for subsidizing the exam fees. But then if you look on Clause C, it then says, but $375,000 is designated for training. And Ms. Peters-Melius has indicated that neither one of the organizations actually need this amount of money, plus there's some federal monies that they can use for some training. And so that this would free this money up, and there would be much more subsidy going for the exam fees for the kids. And it is a conflicting, actually just conflicting language anyway. So the proposal is just to strike Clause C so that it's just clear that both organizations can distribute the money the way they need to. So if they don't need more money for training and they've used all the money they need, then the rest of it can go to the exam fees for the kids. Ms. Peters-Melius, do you want to make any more comments about that? Have you had communications with the APIB people, and are they comfortable with this?
Madam Chair, I have met with both organizations, both the International Baccalaureate Organization and the Advanced Placement Advisory Committee. In fact, I just came from the Advanced Placement Advisory Committee that's meeting this morning, and they were very supportive of this because they realize that it gives them more flexibility in determining how much they want to use for exam fees and how much they need for teacher training and so forth. So there is support from them. One of the other aspects of this is when there's an actual amount written into the law, such as the $375,000, then our Department of Education, which is what I represent, is obligated to encumber that amount for exactly teacher training only, not for other purposes. So that's one of the complications that we discovered.
All right, Representative Devaney.
Madam Chair, I just need clarification that this proposed change doesn't prohibit folks from using the money for teacher training.
No, not at all. Okay. No, if you look in Clause B, each one of those respective organizations will determine the amounts of expenditures each year for exam fees and training and support programs. So they will decide that. And it's my understanding that both organizations have enough training dollars. And in fact, they don't need all of that total $375 that was designated, so it's kind of hamstringing them. The Department of Finances is saying, no, you have to administer it this way, so we're just wanting to clean this up. And in fact, my intent is also to write a letter to say, you know, the intent was, and I guess we just never caught the conflict last year when we wrote the bill, so we're even going to try to, you know, send a letter to share our intent, and then it would be repealed. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if you know this, but I have a bill that has some of this language in it regarding IB. I wanted to know, do you know what this, how much this will reduce the cost? Because I don't know if people on the committee know that kids are paying about $87 to take the test now. In my district, when they take the English test, they have to take two tests. So it's two times $87. And so my bill brought it down to $43. Do you know what this will do?
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, am I correct?
Very good.
Is the difference is if we have to use the $375 for teacher training, the students in AP would receive about $7 per exam. The low-income students, as applicable in the current paragraph D, we have to cover their expenses, which would be $52 per exam. But if we can change that and we can use more of the total funds, and I intend to use the federal dollars for teacher training this next year because I still have carryover funds from the federal grant that I wrote 3 years ago, that would increase the amount per exam to $18. That's not a great increase, but it does make a difference perhaps for some kids who need some help. And so that's one of the things we're hoping for.
Ms. Peters-Melius, when you said $52, is that kind of the average cost for the different exams? Representative Bernardi was saying, what did you say, 67?
I had 87.
87.
Madam Chair, the actual cost of the test for AP is $82. The actual cost of the test for IB is $182. And so the $52 that I was making reference to relates to the fee reduction. The College Board provides a fee reduction for advanced placement, and then the state picks up the difference. And so our part of that would be $52, and that's what I'm obligated then to pay for all low-income students who are taking exams.
So all low-income students would have theirs paid for, and then the other kids based on a fee schedule then? Or is it just all of the kids are paid, have a subsidy, but they would have to pay the remainder of that?
The Madam Chair, the difference might be in the district. In some districts, the district will pick up some of the cost of that exam. In other districts, the students will pay the entire amount of the difference.
Okay.
So.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. All right. If there are no further questions, this bill, 2853, is before us for consideration in the K-12 Education Omnibus Bill. I did move that, did I not? Oh, I did not. Well, then I move it. And then the other item of business that we need to take care of is March 9th minutes.
So moved.
Representative Sikora moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? The minutes of March 9th are approved. This meeting is adjourned.